talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
Good morning. It is August 1st. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
And Roger is here. Roger from Roger's Reels has joined us on the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. He is sitting in the Michelle chair.
Good morning, everybody.
Hey, Roger. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, sir.
Roger is a friend of mine. He's also a movie collector. Roger collects movies on old school 16mm film. Roger, how many movies do you have on 16mm?
Well, it's hard to say right now. I'm hitting about 90 of the Three Stooges shorts.
That's right. Three Stooges is your big thing.
I never really took a count on my reels, but probably somewhere around 40 features,
wow.
50s and 60s TV shows.
Yeah, well, yeah, it looks like you got a whole line of those. Or maybe about 15 or 20 of those, maybe, you think?
Yeah, classic Leave It to Beaver, Andy Griffith Show, Beverly Hillbillies.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some of the great ones.
And right.
Good.
But you're an old movie buff, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've loved films since I was about 10 years
old.
Yeah,
what are some of your favorite movies of all time, Roger?
Well, I was doing some check last night. Of course, I love the early Bond, Sean Connery 007 movies. Son of a Woman with
Al Pacino.
1992 is one of my favorites. And, of course, Fistful of Dollars, 1964, with classic Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns.
Oh, yeah, those are great.
Of course, I love Vincent Price and House on the Haunted Hill,
okay.
One of my all-time favorites. Oh. I'd like to get that print of that, but haven't come across it yet.
It goes pretty high.
We're going down the list here, maybe like Jerry Maguire, or Psycho, Blazing Saddles, Bonnie and Clyde, Titanic.
And you own a print of Bonnie and Clyde, don't you?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I've had several prints of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good. And then The Wolf of Wall Street, Leonardo DiCaprio.
That's a good one.
It's The Aviator, and It's a Wonderful Life. So that's just a few of the good ones.
Well, good.
Oh, yeah. It's an eclectic list.
There you go. Well, thanks for joining us, and we're going to talk a little bit later about your collecting and how you got into collecting and some of your adventures showing your 16mm films and raising money for the Children's Cancer Society. But first, we have to call Michelle McHugh and talk about the top 12 at the box office. We got Michelle McHugh on the phone. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, everyone.
Morning, Michelle.
Good morning.
And you're going to talk about the top 12 at the box office. I think that Bad Moms beat Jason Bourne, am I right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Bad Moms did surprisingly well. Here are the top 12 domestic weekend box office estimates as of Sunday, July 31st. Jason Bourne takes the number one spot with $60 million. Universal's film proved that Matt Damon, in his return to the franchise, was an irresistible draw in 46 international markets as the film grossed $50 million this weekend and combine it for a $110 million take in North America. Notably, it was the number one film at the international box office as well as here in the U.S. and posted the biggest international opening weekend of all the Bourne films.
Of all of them. Yeah.
For an opening weekend.
Huh.
Universal spent $120 million to make the latest installment, and it released it in over 4,000 theaters throughout the U.S. Even with the fair to Midland, reviews, it still did surprisingly well. But, Matt Damon, Jeremy Renner, not so much. Matt Damon, he's still a big draw, so.
And what's this Great Wall we saw trailers for with Matt Damon?
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Did you see that trailer? We saw it before.
Yes,
they showed it to us before Bourne, and I'd never even heard of this movie. But it looks like there's a monster in there somewhere.
That's the M. Night Shyamalan movie.
No, that's not the M. Night Shyamalan movie. We saw that trailer, too. That was called Split.
Right.
Everybody, when they showed that trailer and it said, from the director of Sixth Sense, everybody in the audience groaned.
No, they did, Michelle.
They really did. Everybody really did.
They took the wind out of everybody.
Oh, no, he's coming off The Visit. The Visit was really good. I just watched it the other day.
Okay. Let's move on then. What was number two?
At number two is Star Trek Beyond with $24 million, with a $160 million take worldwide. The third film in the series slipped roughly 60% in its sophomore weekend, That brings the sci-fi sequel's domestic haul to $105.7 million. The film, according to Variety, had a reported $185 million budget. So, you know, and it's still rolling out throughout the world. So, and as Variety reported last week, it still needs to do really well, even though a fourth film has been announced in the latest series. Coming in at number three, this is really good, Bad Moms from STX Entertainment. That film brought in a respectable and healthy $23.4
million.
Uh-huh. And the film starring Mila Kunis et al. Had a $20 million budget, so that's good for them because their last film with Matthew McConaughey, that one.
Oh, Free State of Jones.
Free State of Jones, yeah. That
Free
was
State of Jones did not do so well.
Yeah.
And we all kind of supposed that maybe should have been a end of the year type of, or towards the end of the year release. So it was a funny release date, you know,
okay.
In the middle of blockbusters. So at number four is The Secret Life of Pets, yay.
Yeah.
$18.2 million.
Did you see that, Roger, Secret Life of Pets?
Yes, I did. I thought that was very good. I was okay. I was impressed with the animation and
that's funny,
fun times. Yeah, very good.
It is. It's got a really funny script.
Yeah.
The film brought in an additional $18.2 million, bringing its global total to $395 million. That's huge. So good news for Illumination Studios, too. Lights Out from Warner Brothers Picture was number five with $10.8 million. The horror film's total is now $42.8 million after 2 weeks.
Okay.
So,
it's in the profit mode.
Number six was Ice Age.
Number six is Ice Age Collision from 20th Century Fox. That film brought in $10.5 million, bringing its global total now to $253 million. Good night, nurse. So guess what? More Ice Age to come. Paul Feig's Ghostbusters was number seven with $9.8 million. The domestic haul for that film now finally tipped the scales at $106 million. So that's past the $100 million mark. At number eight was newcomer Nerve from Lionsgate. That film brought in $9 million. So the U.S. ticket sale for that film is $15 million.
Mm-hmm.
So that did really well. At number nine is Finding Dory. Disney film added $4.2 million to its already $830 million worldwide haul. So apparently all three animal / fish / historic dino films are doing fantastic with audiences this summer.
And what about the fourth animal film, Hillary's America, The Secret History of the Democrat Party?
That's coming up. That's number 11. But at number 10 is Legend of Tarzan, which is $4 million. The Lord of the Jungle film has brought in $121 million in the U.S. thus far. And at number 11, as you said, Hillary's America, The Secret Life of $2.4 million. So, it's got an audience. And with the Democratic Convention just wrapping up last week, kind of not surprising. Whether you're pro or con, it's somehow found an audience. And rounding out the 12 is Cafe Society. Woody Allen's film brought in $2.2 million. That's far, $3.9 million to date, and still opening and rolling out in more cities.
All right. So what opens this weekend?
This coming weekend, opening on the 5th of August, is Suicide Squad.
Oh, yeah, Suicide Squad. We're seeing that tonight.
Yes, exactly. The comic book movie is tracking to open as much as $125 million, establishing a new record for an August launch, plus the another animal film, kitty movie, Nine Lives.
Oh, boy, I can't wait to see that. Kevin Spacey is the voice of a cat? That's gold.
You're going to be waiting a while to see it because they ain't going to show it to us.
We'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well,
that's it.
Well, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome.
And you're not going to be able to call in next week, so I'm going to have to do this myself.
Right. I have to give props to Jim and his very nice, very well thought out, very well done obit.
Jack Davis. Yeah, we're going to talk about him again here in a little bit.
Well, thank you, Michelle.
All right. We'll talk to you again. What in 2 weeks?
Yes.
All right. Sounds good.
All right.
See ya. Bye.
See ya.
Bye.
That was Michelle McHugh with the top 10. All right, let's get to work. We got a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about the 21 top movies of the 21st century, which is this big article that I put together with the help of about 30 local film critics and movie buffs and movie writers. And we've also got to talk about a whole bunch of local stuff. And we're going to talk about Roger. But we only got two movies to review. That's good. We can bang out these movies. Let's start with Jason Bourne.
Bourne has to be put down.
I know what you did.
What was the purpose of your visit?
business.
Jason Bourne made $60 million. Kate Marquis reviewed that for WeirdMovieGeeks.com and gave it 3 out of 5. I guess that's about what I would have given it. What did you think of Jason Bourne, Jim?
Maybe a bit more, a bit less on my part. I've just never got into these movies. I guess this is his fourth time as Jason Bourne.
Yeah, and the fifth Bourne movie.
Yeah. And I don't know. It just seems like a lot of stuff I've seen before. Yeah. There's a few twists, a few different locations. I know that my buddy of mine complains about those movies. About the Greengrass films that he uses that Steadicam, and it just drives you nuts after
a
while.
It's not steady enough for me.
No, it kind of makes me
a little nauseous.
It's a boy. I tell you, need some Dramamine at the giving those out at the box office at the ticket booth.
Yeah,
but except it's either these shaky action scenes with Matt Damon, or they're in the control room of the CIA again. Everybody's staring up at monitors.
I know. Did you see this, Roger?
No, sir. I've not seen that yet.
Okay. You seen some of the other Jason Bourne movies?
Yeah, it's been a while. Though.
Okay, well, this new one—if you like the other ones, you'll like this one just fine. But it doesn't stand out within the series. And you talk about the staring at monitors. What a waste of Alicia Vikander! Oh my gosh, here's this sexiest young actress, and here she is. You know, they put her in a suit, and she's standing in these control rooms, looking at monitors and barking orders for like the first 3/4 of the movie. Gee whiz!
No, but Joan Allen was doing that in one of them. That's the thing. These Bourne movies kind of all meld together after a while to me.
Yeah, but Alicia Vikander, I mean, she's so sexy in Ex Machina, where she was this robot, and she gave a terrific performance on top of that, and she was the best thing about The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and the makers of Man from U.N.C.L.E. knew how to use her a lot better than these Bourne people are. I guess she's trying to show some range or something, but she's really kind of dull and misused. And
it certainly was the best thing about Danish Girl, that's for certain. Yeah. There wasn't much good in that, that's for certain.
So,
just staring at monitors. Tommy Lee is the grizzled head of the CIA, and we've seen him kind of do this role before. I don't know. Vincent Cassell is the asset, the assassin, the super assassin that's after Bourne. And there's a big finale in Las Vegas. They introduced this Steve Jobs-like character into the mix who is sort of providing a way for the CIA to spy on everybody, and they have a big computer conference in Vegas, and it's the most over-the-top car crash chase sequence probably since the Blues Brothers.
Yeah, there's two sort of show-stopping chase scenes. There's one on a motorcycle at the beginning that's pretty exciting, but it goes on and on and on and on. And then the one you mentioned where Cassell steals a SWAT truck and runs up and down Las Vegas Strip just plowing cars out of the way. It's sort of spectacular, but I tell you, I think, you know, Mad Max is just a little too fresh for any car chase to get me excited at this point. And it goes on and on, and it's pretty exciting, but you know, standalone from the rest of this movie, it's kind of the highlight, but that's not saying a whole lot.
And, you know, Matt Damon is kind of in the grim, determined mode through the whole thing. There's very little of the...
Everybody is.
Yeah.
Does anybody smile in this movie?
Yeah, no, never, I don't think. Yeah.
At least the Bond movies and the Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movies, there's some levity here and there,
but it's not always about some shadowy conspiracy, and there's a new program that has a code name. What is it? Was it this one, Threadbare or something like that? I don't know. I know the people love these movies, but they just don't do a thing for me. I feel like I've, you know, this is kind of familiar territory, I guess.
All right, so neither Jim and I can recommend Jason Bourne very much. I guess there's nothing else to see out there. You might have an okay time. Let's move on, though, to the other movie that we saw this week. It was called Nerve.
Watchers pay to watch. Players play to win cash and glory. Are you a watcher or a player? Are you a watcher or a player? Are you a watcher, player, watch, player?
It's cool, right?
This looks very sketchy. Is this legal?
I reviewed that over at WeirdMovieGeeks.com. I gave it 3.5 out of 5 stars. It's not bad. It's very popular in my house. Both of my kids have seen Nerve, and they both really loved it a lot. My 17-year-old saw it just yesterday afternoon, and I took my 12-year-old to the screening with me, and I told the young woman from Elliot I'd give it 3 out of 5 stars, and she piped in, I'd give it 5 out of 5 stars. So it's aimed at teenagers. It's based on a young adult novel, and it's about Emma Roberts, and she plays a character named V, and she's sort of a high school student, even though Miss Roberts is, I think, 26 years old.
Yeah, you must have gotten a lot of thank you letters from agents and things like that for listing the ages of all the female stars of the film.
Yes, I did. I got several.
But she not got the male stars, of course.
No. Well, and then Dave Franco. Well, then she starts playing this this phone game where she's challenged to these increasingly risky series of dares. and she gets paid money, and she has a joint checking account with her mother, played by Juliette Lewis, who's a nurse working night shift at a hospital, and she keeps looking at her phone because wondering why all these deposits are being made into their checking account.
Seems like it was only yesterday Juliette Lewis was the daughter in the remake of Cape Fear. It just doesn't seem she should have a daughter that's in high school.
I'm not too happy about that either. It all takes place in one night, which I think works. That kind of structure kind of works in its favor because it is pretty fast-paced. It's fairly exciting and intense. I don't like movies where teenagers are at the front and center, though, because I never feel like the dialogue is particularly believable. They're never acting like teenagers in these films. But unlike a lot of these young adult novels, it's sort of lean and economic. It only runs about 95 minutes. And again, with the one-night structure, I think it moves at a pretty brisk clip. And it's a pretty exciting movie up until the end. It really falls apart at the end. It doesn't really sustain its excitement. And it gets kind of ridiculous. They steal guns, and there's gunplay. And then there's like, all of a sudden, there's 400 or 500 of these watchers have gathered in some sort of underground garage. And
it's Thunderdome!
Yeah, and they're wearing these bandanas that look like they have like skulls on them, like something out of the Purge movie. Or something. That gets really ridiculous.
The police are not aware of these 500 people off of Manhattan Island all gathered.
Yeah.
They're not being touched. Yeah. There's no helicopters or whatever circling them.
So the ending's ridiculous, but getting to the ending is actually pretty fun. There's a good scene where Dave Franco is riding his motorcycle blindfolded and trying to get up to 60 miles an hour. That's their dare. And that sort of had you on the edge. There's a cute scene where they go and they try on clothes at this upscale boutique, and their clothes get stolen, and they're running around the store in their underwear. That was kind of nice. It has its moments. Miss Roberts is a little bland for the role. Who's the actress that played her friend Sid?
Oh, I know. She stole Money Monster a few months ago, and I can't recall
I can't remember her name either.
She's terrific in a really obnoxious role.
Yeah. She's sort of the more damaged best friend of Emma Roberts, but she's pretty good, actually. She's better than Miss Roberts. Dave Franco, he's okay.
They're both
a little forgettable.
I don't think they've got much chemistry together, really, in it.
So I don't know. It's not bad. I gave it 3.5 stars because I think it's a movie that works while you're watching it. But then you get home and the next day you just like totally forgot about it.
Yeah, I'd give about a half a star less than that. Okay. I just thought, you know, the whole, you know, people watching in and the whole online stuff, it just promoting ignorance, it seemed like. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, they're just so silly in this.
So I sort of recommend Nerve. It's not the greatest movie in town, but if there's nothing else to see, Nerve isn't a total waste of time. And that's all the movies we have to review. Crazy. But there are a couple of movies that we're going to review next week because we're seeing tonight Suicide Squad.
This is the deal. You're going somewhere very bad.
Look at the pretty lights.
To do something that'll get you killed. You might want to work on your team motivation thing. You heard of Phil Jackson?
Yeah.
He's like the gold standard. Okay? Triangle, bitch.
Yes, the new attempt to get the DC Comics movieverse back on track. Be interesting. This will be the first time we've seen the Joker in a film since Heath Ledger's unfortunate passing a few years ago. Jared Leto, Oscar winner for Dallas Buyers Club, is putting his own little spin on it. It'll be interesting to see that. Supposedly, we'll see Mr. Affleck again as Batman.
Who's Will Smith play?
Will Smith is playing in a super assassin named Deadshot.
Okay.
And it's kind of an interesting premise. I think when Suicide Squad first started at DC Comics, it was sort of a version of comics version of the Dirty Dozen.
Yeah, that's the old classic plot.
They sort of updated it about 10 years ago, and they made it instead of these soldiers in World War II, it's comic book supervillains that are incarcerated, and their chance for survival or getting years taken off their sentence is to be part of these missions. And I guess they've got control chips in them so that if they do try to escape, they get zapped into oblivion.
They should give Clint Walker a cameo.
Just the
heck. All right. Well, so we're seeing that tonight, and we'll be back to review that. Who's reviewing that, Michael?
I think Michael. It's directed and written by David Ayers, who we last heard of in Fury.
The Fury. Yeah, that was a pretty good
movie,
actually.
Movie.
Yeah. Yeah, that was excellent. All right, and then I guess The only other movie opening Friday is The Nine Lives. Is that the name of it?
Yeah, Nine Lives. Nine Lives. Yeah, with Kevin Spacey. I guess he gets zapped by Christopher Walken as a character named Felix.
Oh, good.
Into the body of a cat.
I hate this movie already.
Yeah, well, I was stunned. I checked it on IMDb. It's actually directed by Barry Sudenfeld, who's done the Men in Black films, a lot of really great films.
Well, he was
and
the
a lot
cinematographer for the early Coen brothers.
Yeah, but he's done, he did the Addams Family movies, which I enjoyed quite a bit. But then again, he's done a lot of junk over the last few years, too, so this might fall into that category.
All right. Well, I don't know if we'll have a review of that next week or not. Maybe we will, if one of us sees it. All right. Let's talk about some stuff going on locally. Roger is my partner with this monthly film series that I do over at the Way Out Club called 16mm Double Feature Night. And tomorrow night we're showing King Kong versus Godzilla, which is a print from my buddy Mike Doogie's collection. Double feature with St. Ives, starring Charles Bronson and John Houseman, and that's from my collection.
One of the most unlikely double feature pairings of all time.
All the 16mm double features are unlikely. That's the theme. There is no theme.
And I think you said the Godzilla King Kong movie is the first color.
Yeah, the first colored Godzilla movie. Yeah,
Godzilla
1962.
Movie, yes.
Yeah. It's really fun too. It's a ride. Have you ever seen it?
No, I don't believe I have.
It's got a goofy charm to it that it's hard to resist.
It's a lot of fun. So you'll be seeing it tomorrow night for sure because that'll be fun. But now we can announce for the first time anywhere what our lineup is for next month, which will be September 6th. And both of these films are from Roger's collection. Roger, you want to make the big announcement?
Well, it seems looks like we're going to have 4D Man.
The 4D Man.
Oh, Robert Lansing.
Robert Lansing and Lee Merriweather and I think a very young Patty Duke. I think she's 11 or 12, has a part in this film as well.
I think that film has been rarely seen. Yeah. I mean, this is a black and white print of a color film,
which I guess they did that fairly often back in the day when they would sell. I guess, black and white stock was cheaper to produce and to buy.
Well, I think what they did the black and white, like you say, lesser cost. Mm-hmm. And also, when they broadcast it on television, it was black and white because they didn't have color TV.
That could be part of it as well.
Yeah, I recall seeing 4D Man in the back of famous monsters, always in the Captain Company ads for their little 8mm condensation of it.
But yeah, Robert Lansing, he does a very good job, and it's a different sort of movie. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember what year it was.
59.
59. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. And Lansing was best known for TV, wasn't he, on the 12 o'clock high TV show?
Yeah, 12 o'clock high TV show. Was a regular on The Equalizer also.
And he was also in that Star Trek episode with Terry Garr that was going to be a spinoff and it was on series.
But what was that again? I'm sorry. What was that one?
Original Star Trek.
I was thinking it was a Simon Earth, but that might not be the exact. But it was kind of, like a proposed spinoff
But I always associate Robert Lansing with the 4D Man because it's a movie I've seen many, many times. And what are we going to show that double feature with, Roger?
Okay, we're going to go with the drive-in B-movie. Crazy Larry and Dirty Mary.
Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry.
Yeah, with Susan George and Peter Fonda.
Peter Fonda, right. And Vic Morrow is the cop, the sheriff that's on their tail.
And he is definitely obsessed of getting this guy here.
He's great. Yeah. And Adam Rourke is sort of the third guy in the car with them. He was in a lot of biker movies. And Roddy McDowall, I believe, plays the guy that they rob at the beginning.
I don't recall. It's been a while since I've seen it. But, it's
one of the car, sort of the car culture classics from the 70s. People who like cars and muscle cars love, there's a certain genre of movies that came out in the 70s, Vanishing Point and that, and Gone in 60 Seconds.
Well, this was like a couple of years before Smokey and the Bandit,
kind of ending, kind of ending with Smokey and the Bandit. And you own a print of Smokey and the Bandit as well.
Yes, I do.
Which we've seen.
And the Peter Fonda car, I believe, is a 66 Chevrolet. I'm not sure if it's a Caprice or Impala, but it's one of the big blocks. Mm-hmm. So.
And the color on that, I think, is pretty good, because remember you showed it at Schlafly a few years ago.
Yes.
I remember stopping by. So the color on that one's going to be great. The 4D Man is a color film. Like we say, that's a black and white print. So that'll be September 6th at the Way Out Club. The Way Out Club is, of course, at 2525 Jefferson. And we start at 8 o'clock. It is free, but we set out a jar to accept donations for the National Children's Cancer Society. So put that on your calendar. Other things going on Wednesday night over at Schlafly Bottle Works at 7 o'clock is The Blob. And you know what's crazy? The Blob was directed by Irving Yeworth, and he also directed The 4D Man.
So
it's Irving Yeworth week here in St. St. Louis. The Blob, of course, our Steve McQueen. It was made in 1958, a year before The 4D Man. And Anita Corso, wasn't she on the Andy Griffith Show?
Miss Crump.
That's right. She's in it. And, you know, one thing, I love The Blob. I grew up with it. One of the cool things about The Blob is that theme song at the beginning.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor.
Yeah, Burt Bacharach. And Hal David had something to do with that.
It was Burt Bacharach wrote that song and composed it. What other monster or science fiction movie from the 50s or 60s has a theme song with lyrics? You think about it, seriously.
Really?
You'd have to go up to like The Green Slime.
Yeah, The Fly didn't have
no,
one.
No, none of them did. Yeah. I can't think of a single horror sci-fi movie from that era that had a theme song with lyrics, and it's a great song. So that's Webster University's Strange Brew Film Series. That's 8 o'clock Wednesday night. Thursday night, also at Schlafly Bottleworks, I'll be hosting a screening of Reefer Madness. Have you ever seen Reefer Madness, Roger?
Oh, yeah. That's quite the flick for that time era.
Yeah. 1936 it was made, and it was made as an anti-marijuana propaganda film. That was when they were starting to write laws about marijuana. But then, I guess, it was made about 30 or 40 years later, sort of college students sort of rediscovered it and thought it was sort of a fun movie to laugh at because of sort of the overtop portrayal of people high on grass. And they used to play it midnights. And I remember seeing it at the old Ritz Theater on Grand back in the late 70s.
Oh, yeah, Dave O'Brien, the great stuntman, is one of the characters in that. Yeah.
So that's this Thursday, which is 4th at 8 o'clock, or 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock over at Schlafly Bottleworks. That is the A Film Series, and I do host that along with my friend Amy Barnes. And that is a fundraiser for Helping Kids Together, which raises money to send kids with health issues on trips. Friday night, there's lots going on in town this week.
Sounds great.
Always is, though. St. Louis is a great place to live if you're a movie buff. Friday night, midnight at the Tivoli, The Room.
You are lying. I nearly hit you. You are tearing me apart, Lisa.
I always get excited about The Room. The Room is, have you ever heard of The Room or seen The Room?
No, I have not seen
it. Okay, Room was made in 2003 and was starring, written, and directed by Tommy Wiseau. Last time we showed The Room was last summer, and Tommy Wiseau was actually in town to host it. It's the worst movie ever made by far. But it's so bad, it's hilarious, and it's kind of interactive, and people yell the lines and come back to the lines, and they throw things at the screen, and it's crazy. I mean, The Room at midnight at the Tivoli is nuts, and it will have huge crowds Friday and Saturday night. It's a riot.
Oh, Mr. Wiseau isn't going to be here for it this time, is he?
No, not this time.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully we've had him twice. We had him last summer and I think 2 years before that. He's a knucklehead.
It's kind of a cult type movie.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. And it's kind of a miserable movie just to sit and watch by yourself. But watching it with an audience is a lot of fun. And one other local thing I want to talk about, well, I have your attention, is Tenacious Eats Movies for Foodies. That's another movie event that I host. It is put on by our friends and chefs over at Tenacious Eats. And what they do is they show a movie and they serve a 5 or 6 course gourmet meal while the movie is playing. They usually take the summer off, so we haven't done one of these in a few months. But coming up, I should say, on August 13th, which is a Saturday, and the first movie of this season is Julia and Julie. Or is it Julie and Julia?
Julia, I guess.
It's kind of a schizophrenic movie about Julia Childs. And it's really good when it focuses on Julia Childs, but then it cuts to these sequences that take place in present day with Amy Adams. And those scenes are actually really lame.
Chris Messina is her boyfriend. Stanley Tucci is Julia Child's wife, or husband. That stuff's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that stuff's really good. That's August 13th, which is a Saturday. You can go to tenaciouseats.com and see if there's any tickets left. I know these things always sell out, so it may be already sold out. I'm just not sure. And I know in a couple weeks after that, we're doing Ferris Bueller's Day Off. This is a lot of fun. It's well worth it. The food's amazingly good. All right, let's talk about some other stuff. 21 movies that are the best movies of the 21st century so far. That means all the movies made between the years 2000 and 2016. I had this great idea that I would poll all the local movie buffs in town. So I did. I got 30 lists of the top 10 movies of the 21st century so far from local movie critics, movie bloggers, movie academics, movie buffs, movie writers, et cetera, et cetera. I got 30 lists of the top 10, and I ran them through a super top secret scientific program and came out with a... basically, I came up with a scoring list. If somebody, I had them do an in order of preference. So if a movie was number one on their list, that movie got 10 points. If it was number two on their list, it got 9 points. You following me?
If
it was number three on their list, it got
to,
8 points.
Easier to follow than Jason Bourne.
Yes. But if it was number 10 on their list, it got 1 point. So that's how I decided to score these things. My wife actually said, well, you should score them this other way. And she had some other way I should have scored them. But my eyes glazed over because I'm bad at math. I thought that was pretty fair. I don't know what.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. Yeah.
Yeah. And there were some surprises on here. Let's go ahead and run this down. I'm going to actually put an article up this week at WeAreMovieGeeks.com where I am going to list these as well as everybody's individual list. So you're going to see 30 writers, individual lists of their top 10 of the...
You'll be able to point at them and chuckle.
Exactly.
Like, you thought that was good?
But as far as movies that were on multiple lists and were near the top of a lot of lists, here is the top 21 movies of the 21st century so far. Number 21 was Gladiator. Ridley Scott's 2000 epic that won the Oscar for Best Picture. You ever seen that, Roger?
No, I did not see
you ever seen that?
I've never seen Gladiator.
Russell Crowe,
really?
It was Oliver Reed's last film. It's classic.
It was a big box office hit.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Go rent it. Number 20 is Up, one of three animated films that ended up on this list.
Oh, that's a good one.
It is a good one. Number 19 was another animated film, The Lego Movie.
Yeah.
We're all scratching our heads right now.
Yeah.
But then again, that only ended up on two lists out of 30, but it was number one on both of those lists. So it got 20 points, which barely made it into the top 21. So, you know, fair is fair, I guess. Number 18 was another movie that won the Oscar for Best Picture, the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men.
Pretty good flick.
Oh, great flick.
Yeah.
But it's not the top-scoring Coen brothers movie. I'll get to that here in a minute.
Yeah.
Number 17 was 12 Years a Slave, another Oscar-winning best film. It wasn't on my list, but it's...
It's kind of popular.
An overrated film. Number 16 was The Revenant, just from last year.
Yeah. I saw some article in the paper. Some guy is claiming that, you know, the reason he went out and shot a bear is because he just seen that movie.
and he was paranoid about
the bear attacking his family.
Yeah.
The Revenant.
Yeah. Have you seen The Revenant, Roger?
No, I have not.
I'm your Leo fan. That's the same.
Yeah. It looked pretty dark.
Oh, it's great.
Oh, yes.
You'll like it. Go get it. All right. Number 15 is the third animated film. That's Inside Out. Pixar's Inside Out from last year. That's a great animated film.
That is pretty great.
I didn't have any animated films on my list, but if I had, I probably would have put Inside Out.
My Pixar animated film on my list was The Incredibles, which I'm looking forward to a sequel, hopefully.
That didn't make the top 21 movies of the 21st century list, but Lego Movie did.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move along. Number 14 was The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, directed by Michael Gondry and written by Charlie Kaufman. There's another Charlie Kaufman movie on here as well. That's a good movie. Everybody likes that movie.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of it, but that's okay. Number 13 was the other Coen Brothers movie that I mentioned. It is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? You ever seen that one, Roger?
Yeah, people were telling me how great it was, and I was...
Not a big fan of that movie?
No, I just thought it was fair, but I watched it all the way through.
You gotta get that soundtrack. That CD is so great.
Yeah, that was a big seller. All right, number 12 was the only Quentin Tarantino movie on the list, and that is Inglourious Basterds. That was on my list. In fact, that was number 3 on my list. That's a great film.
Yeah, almost made mine. Yeah, very close.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Django was on a couple of lists. And Kill Bill was on a couple of lists.
Maybe Kill Bill was on my list.
I think Kill Bill was on your list. And moving on, number 11 was The Aviator, which is one of two Martin Scorsese movies. It's a great movie.
Yes.
Number 10 was Schenectady, New York. Which was written by Charlie Kaufman. Was that directed by Kaufman, or was that directed by Michael Gondry as well?
I think that was Charlie,
You think that was directed by Charlie
Kaufman? Yeah, that star Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's the only movie on this list that I didn't see on the big screen. I caught up with it later. All right, let's move on. Number 9. Oh, we're in the top 10 now. Number 9 was Memento. That was the only Christopher Nolan film on the list, although a lot of Christopher Nolan movies appeared on people's lists. Tons of them. Batman was doing okay. I thought Batman was going to be in the top 21, but
The Dark Knight.
Didn't quite make the final cut. Number 8, The Royal Tenenbaums. That's the only Wes Anderson movie on the list. I'm surprised Grand Budapest Hotel didn't get a little more love, but I'm glad it wasn't. What was that one I hated so much?
Moonrise Kingdom.
Moonrise Kingdom. Oh, yeah. Good. Royal Tenenbaums is a classic and a great swan song for Gene Hackman. Number seven was Boyhood. That was high on a lot of people's lists.
Oh, yeah.
You seen that one, Roger? Boyhood?
Yeah, a very long movie, but it was 12 years in the making or something like that. Yeah. That's just...
A lot of people love that movie.
Absolutely
fun.
Incredible.
Yeah. And number six, Lord of the Rings, Return of the Rings. That was on a lot of people's list.
Oh, Return of the King.
Return of the King, I'm sorry.
That was on my list.
It was on your list. And it was funny, though, because Michelle actually had Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers on her list.
Okay, the second one.
Maybe she had Fellowship of the Rings.
And then
Matt Meyer from Allied, he had The Two Towers. So if they would have gone with... If they'd have switched their votes to Return of the King... Return of the King would have been way near number one.
Didn't they do all three of those at one time?
They did, but they still count as three films.
In fact,
two people actually turned in their list and had Lord of the Rings trilogy as a number, and I sent it back to him. I said that's not a movie. I can't score it.
Yeah.
You're going to have to redo this. Let's see. We're down to the top five. The top five. Number five is the other Martin Scorsese movie, The Departed, which won the Oscar for Best Picture. Not one of my favorite Scorsese movies, but it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
Number four was number one on my list. Number four is Mad Max Fury Road. That was on a lot of people's list. In fact, 4, 3, 2, and 1 were all pretty tight. Mad Max Fury Road, great, great movie. Three was Pan's Labyrinth. The only foreign language film on this list that was a Spanish language film.
Yeah, people, I say we critics are snobby and we only like foreign films. And there's only one foreign film in this 21. Listen, there's a lot of box office hits. There's a lot of Best Picture winners.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, but Pan's Labyrinth was my number one on my list.
Yeah, I think so. And it was number one on a couple other lists. Number two is There Will Be Blood, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, with a great Oscar-winning performance by Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
That's a terrific movie. So it wasn't on my list, but I think it's great that it's number two. And number one was kind of a surprise.
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah.
It is actually number one. Where's the drum roll? Roger, you can bring your snare drum. There you go. Number one was David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
Really? Which started out, as I understand, a TV pilot, right? Pilot for a series, and they decided that no network picked it up, and they decided to expand it into a feature film.
It is a great movie. It's probably my favorite David Lynch movie, and I think it's great that it is number one on the top 21 movies of the 21st century list so far, which will be an article later this week at WeirdMovieGeeks.com, so go look for that.
Confession, I've never seen it, so I will have to watch it.
Which one?
The number one.
You've never seen Mulholland Drive?
No, I've not seen the whole thing, just bits and pieces over the years.
Jim has never seen Mulholland Drive. All right, Roger is our guest in the studio, Roger from Roger's Reels. Roger sets up 16mm films around town. We said he was a collector, and every time you set up a 16mm film, you try to raise some money for the National Children's Cancer Society. Is that right? What's your relationship with the National Children's Cancer Society? How'd you get involved with that particular charity?
Well, it was probably about 20 years ago. I belonged to a First Capital Classics car club out in St. Charles years ago. Once a year, we have a car show that we raise money for, whether it be American Cancer Society or some others, and then the National Children's Cancer Society came along, based here in St. Louis, and they help families with kids that have cancer. They help with medical expenses, travel, lodging, and things like that when the insurance companies finally make their maximum. So we've been, I think this year is our 20th year at Westport. I think it's a Sunday after Labor Day weekend that we have our annual car show, and all the money raised goes to the foundation. So we probably, on an average, raise about between $10,000 and $14,000 a year for that.
All right, good.
Yes.
We already talked about your collection, but you said you got a lot of Stooges. You got 90. How many Stooges were there?
I think there was 198.
Yeah, that sounds right, from 34 to 59.
And
right?
You got 90, you say?
Yeah, I think I got 90 right now. 90.
So you're almost halfway there.
Yeah.
So you've got the second one. It starts with, you don't have Woman Haters, I take it.
No, I don't have Woman Haters.
You got Punch Drunks, though.
Punch Drunk is
one.
Number two.
Yeah.
And then.
What's your favorite of the Stooges shorts?
Well, I like An Ache in Every Steak.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Stooge to Conga.
Pardon me?
They Stooge to Conga.
Oh, absolutely. That's the probably the all time.
Yeah. It's supposed to be the most painful one.
Right. It's supposed to be the most violent of all the Stooges with.
And that's saying something, folks.
Yeah, but it's just that one is nonstop from probably beginning to the end. Of course, it was in the war era, and they did a lot of parody on that with Mo Howard dressed up as Adolf Hitler, looks exactly like him.
Yeah.
But, and of course, that Punch Drunks is written by the boys. They actually have a screen credit for the story and screenplay of that. So
I don't really watch much of the credits, but you're probably right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I guess I've been collecting the Stooges for about 25 years.
Were you collecting Stooges first and then got into features, or kind of all at the same time?
No, I started out probably with some of the Little Rascals, the classic black and white Black Hawks, and started out with some of the 50s and 60s TV shows, and then little by little got into the Stooges and then started getting into the feature movies. I think I have somewhere around 40 features right now.
Yeah. Well, back in the day, I guess when these TV shows went into syndication, the movie studio Scream Gems or whoever would just send the 16mm prints to all the stations. I don't know if they would have to send them back or send them on to another station.
Yeah,
but
probably.
Before the days of satellite transmissions and discs and that sort of thing. Oh, about the Stooges, it's pretty much just Curly and Shemp. No Bessers, no Joe DiRigo. Features.
No, I don't. I know that Joe Besser was very, very popular back in the mid to late 50s and very much in demand. I do know I heard a tidbit of information that when they hired Joe Besser, that he ended up making more than Mo Howard. And Mo Howard.
Well, he was already under contract with Columbia.
Yeah. So he already was extremely upset about that, of course. So
and he also wouldn't, and Joe Besser wouldn't let Larry and Mo hit him in the head or the face.
Yeah, they had a no slap clause in his contract.
Yeah,
yes.
I guess they punched him in the stomach a few times, but his face was off limits.
Kind of like
Ron Burgundy's hair.
Indeed. Yeah, so you got the TV to the TV episodes. You said it's mostly Annie Griffith, Beaver. You got some I Love Lucy's, right?
You brought some to the Whale Club. You
couple
had Monsters.
Couple Superman, the original Happy Superman.
Days. Oh, you got some George Reeves Superman. Yeah,
The original.
Now the color episodes, or are they?
I have one color, and the rest are black and white.
From those first couple of seasons.
Superman gets married. You brought that over to the Way Out Club a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's one that hasn't been seen too much. That's a nice color episode.
Yeah.
It's a nice showcase for the recently departed Noel Neal, too. That's for certain.
Yeah, I heard about that a couple of weeks ago, right?
Yeah. And, one of the Lucys you have has Superman in it, right?
Correct.
That's right. That's right.
Also, Lucy meets Harpo Marx.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. That's a classic. Mm-hmm. So, they're getting, scarcer and scarcer, it seems like. I mean,
you don't have any of the hour detective shows or westerns or anything like that, do you?
No, I don't have any of the hour shows I can think of off the top of my head right now. But
we were at your house last week, and I had bought an episode of Yancey Derringer from 1959.
That was
we
good.
We watched that down in your basement. That was really good. Special guest villain Charles Bronson on that one.
Yes.
Yeah, but he's not completely evil in it, so that's kind of interesting. Yeah.
And the Gatling gun was something else, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a very entertaining episode.
Roger and I belong to a club. What's that club called? The Saturday Night Screeners? And we get together once a month, and it's all a bunch of 16mm film collectors. And we watch a movie in somebody's basement every month. And that's where I met Roger. I met Roger five, 6 years ago. And it was some guy's backyard. And it seems like you often run the projector. And you were showing your print of Von Ryan's Express.
Very good print. Yes, good color. Yeah. Great cast. Yeah. And we did that outdoors. And we're planning to do another one this year. But we'll see how that goes. Weather permitting, of course.
Yeah. Everybody in Saturday Night Screeners has their own movie theater base in their basement, which is kind of cool.
That is nice.
You got a nice setup at your house.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, very nice.
And appreciate that.
And Phil has a nice setup. And who's that one guy, Bill Ryan or Jim Ryan?
Yeah, Jim Ryan.
He's got a nice setup in his basement, too. And he's got a big, giant Wurlitzer organ. Apparently, that's his passion is to show silent films and jump on his organ and play music. Although I don't think he plays the organ, does he?
No, I don't. I think his wife does.
His wife
does.
And
then they also sometimes have a guest player come in and do the organ and accompaniment with the silent film, which is very entertaining.
Yeah.
So talk about these prints, color prints of 16mm. Sometimes you get them and you throw them on the projector and you get all excited and they're all red. What causes a movie to turn red like that?
Well, basically what happens is it's the process of how it was developed at the
the lab.
At the lab, and you know, like some of the TV shows back in the color days, first color days, they would process them as quickly as possible mm-hmm. to get them out to the syndication areas and things like that. So, actually, what happens with a print that turns red is that over time, it's still developing in the inside the cans, and, mm-hmm. and red being the last color that's mm-hmm. that, because eventually the
so the color the chemicals just sort of turn over
the
years.
Greens. Yeah, they start to
go away. But sometimes prints look spectacular.
Yeah,
they don't fade at all. I know we watched your print of Dillinger a couple of months ago. Boy, that looked like it was just struck yesterday.
It's a different film stock that they used back in the started in the early 80s. It's a LPP, which is mm-hmm. what they call it, a low fade print, mm-hmm. and apparently is not Technicolor, which of mm-hmm. course Technicolor will not fade, and they bring some top dollars with Technicolor mm-hmm. prints, but LPP prints are. Holding up very well through the years here. It's like 30 years. So
So you always got to check, you know, if you're buying a print from eBay or something like that, you got to say what, you know, I know people sell on eBay and they don't even mention what the color is like. That's always a red flag.
Yeah.
Well, I think sometimes these people get estate sales and they really mm-hmm. don't know much about the product and they try to put it out there and you get try to ask questions, and they don't know what you're talking about. So,
well, yes, I say that your what the film we watched the other day is kind of your mystery film. You'd you'd gotten it, Tom, without knowing much about it.
Yeah,
at
we watched that down in Roger's basement last week. It was at the toy show of all places, and some guy had a print of a movie called Murder Party, and I was completely unfamiliar with this movie called Murder Party. I looked it up on IMDb, and the only Murder Party listed was a German movie from 1960, a German thriller. You know, this guy wanted a whole lot of money for it, and I said, look, you know, I don't know what kind of shape this in. Nobody else here is going to buy it. So I talked him way down to less than half of what he originally wanted. And I got it home, and I started watching it. It was pretty exciting. It was a pretty neat little crime thriller, but then it started breaking in my projector, and there must have been, 15, 20 splices in the thing, and they've been patched together with scotch tape that had deteriorated over the years. So I gave it to Roger. Roger's got a lot of 16-millimeter equipment, and he repaired it for me. Thank you, Roger. And a bunch of us went over to his house last week, and it was like rediscovering some lost classic crime film, because it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's great era, the Mad Men type of thing, mm-hmm. with the suits and drinking and smoking
definitely.
And a lot of subjective camera work, a lot of it.
Yeah, this is like maybe a year or so after Peeping Tom or something.
Yeah,
The camera work was different in places. It was very, very unique.
Yeah, it was amazing. And then sometimes you get prints that are like TV prints. We showed Capone a couple of months ago over at the Way Out Club. Now, I'd seen that at the theater, the R-rated version, and there's kind of an infamous scene with Susan Blakely doing some full frontal nudity, and your print had that scene in it, but she's wearing a nightgown, so they had obviously shot an alternate take for a TV print, and some of the blood was cut out and some of the other nudity, but sometimes TV prints can actually be better. Well, I don't know if better is the right word, but can be sort of interesting. Phil's print of Blazing Saddles, which we talked at length about, it's actually longer than the theatrical print.
Yeah, they had 15 minutes that was not shown in the theaters that they put into this print. So,
well, they've got the governor and his people visiting the fake Rock Ridge at one point in the middle of the desert, which it was not in the theatrical release. So,
And of course, Blazing Saddles has the N-word in it, 25 times probably. And but then TV print, interestingly enough, they leave in the N-word. There's even a scene where an old lady approaches Black Bart and says, "Up yours, N-word." Well, in the TV print, it says, "Out of my way, N-word." So they leave the N-word in, but they had to get rid of "up yours." I mean, that was probably in the mid-70s, maybe 3 or 4 years after the movie was made.
That's one of my all-time favorites. Mel Brooks, also Young Frankenstein, which he did the same year.
Yeah.
You've got a print of Young Frankenstein.
You do. We've watched your print of Young Frankenstein a couple of times. I think I've seen it 3 times because you showed it at Schlafly once.
Man.
We've shown it at the Way Out Club a couple of times.
Yeah, that's Mel Brooks' fine job. It'd be a great loss when he's gone. I guess he's probably in his 90s now.
Yeah, he just turned 90. Right. Yeah. Wow. So, yeah.
All right. Well, Roger, again, thanks a lot for joining us, and thanks for teaming up for a 16-millimeter double feature tonight. Now we're going to talk about somebody who died. Jim wrote a obituary for artist Jack Davis over at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. He goes into detail about Jack Davis's career. And Jack Davis is definitely a movie figure because he painted and drew a lot of sort of iconic movie posters. Jim, talk some more about Jack Davis.
Yeah. A lot of folks might have seen that listing and going, well, what's a cartoonist? He's not an animator like Chuck Jones or Friz Freleng. He's not an animation producer like Walt Disney. What did he have to do? Well, actually, Jack started out as mostly as a comic book artist. He was one of the founding members of the EC Entertaining Comics bullpen. He actually had a hand in designing the Crypt Keeper for the Tales from the Crypt comics, and he worked on all their books. But then Harvey Kurtzman and Bill Gates teamed up to create Mad Magazine. Well, then it was a four-color comic book. Yeah. Then it was Jack Davis, Wally Wood, and Bill Elder, mostly satirizing current comic books, and that later became a magazine. Well, everyone was amazed that Jack Davis, who was mostly known as a horror artist or Western artist, could do humor stuff. So then the advertising agencies started calling the magazine covers and movie studios to do movie posters. He started doing movie posters in the late 50s, but then in, about 1963, came his most famous movie poster, the incredible It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. I used to have the record album, which sort of had a little fold-out thing. You could stretch out and see the whole design of all the different versions of the actors and actresses. Just fantastic. He went on to do more and more great movie posters. He did The Bad News Bears. He did Inspector Clouseau, The Flim Flam Man, The Long Goodbye, which was in the style of a Mad Magazine illustration.
I've got that poster.
But he does have a screen credit. He hooked up with a company called Rankin Bass, the Rudolph the Reindeer people, and they decided to use him to design the monsters for Mad Monster Party, the 67 feature film. So he does have one screen credit, but he's mostly known for these fantastic movie posters.
And Mad Magazine covers, of course.
And TV Guide covers, and just about
very
anything
prolific.
Credit. And actually, one of the prize pieces that you have, Tom, is the Man from U.N.C.L.E. lunchbox that
did the Air War. That was the only lunchbox he did.
Yeah, I believe so. And it's fantastic. Well, everything he did was fantastic. Mm-hmm. So he made it to 91 last week.
All right. Well, so RIP Jack Davis and RIP this show, because we got to wrap it up, doggone it. Roger, again, thanks for joining us. Listen again next week. We're going to review Suicide Squad and maybe Nine Lives. And then there's a couple of landmark films that Jim saw that we'll review as well. But for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Betts.
Roger from Roger Reels.
All right. Listen again next week.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and slides across the floor.
Hello, Don.
Thank you. crash, crash. Black leather, smash, smash, smash.